You're listening to The Dead Prussian, a podcast about war and warfare.
We talk a lot about war, warfare, ways of fighting, policy, and just generally the punchy side of war and conflict on this show, which is actually appropriate because it's a podcast about war and warfare. We've also had one episode with Azar Gutt, and go back and listen to that one about the decline of war and the cause of peace and how peace is on the rise. A lot of people may not think that's correct. I've had a lot of feedback on that. But one thing we've missed in all this discussion so far is a discussion about peace, insecurity, representations of war, representations of peace, and representations of insecurity. And I know that all my listeners have noticed this obvious gap in the show. G'day listeners, and welcome to the Dead Prussian podcast, the only podcast out there named after a 19th century Prussian military theorist. Now, I've got to be very careful when I do that intro, because there is another podcast out there that is named after his book. A couple of young international relations students, please give it a listen. I'm not going to tell you the name of the podcast because it's the start of my show and I need you to listen to this episode beforehand. Also, you've noticed our Patreon page. Please jump on there, sign up, and you get some member benefits. What benefits? Well, you can join our book club. You get access to the transcripts once we've hit our fundraising goal, and we'll provide all our transcripts to all our members. And the funny thing is, all our guests also get their transcripts as well. So if you are a guest on the show, you get a transcript. But you've also got to be very interesting to come on the show. Almost as interesting as me. And also, if you want bonus episodes, yes, that's right, bonus episodes of me going into topics in a deeper level, then you have to sign up. Good examples are, I used a fictional trilogy, I won't tell you which one, to explore strategy, tactics, and military operations. And we're currently deep diving from a criminological point of view on the behaviour of violence and where violence comes from, where it goes, and how it affects people. But we're not talking about that today. We're not talking about our membership. We're talking about something completely different. We're talking about young people, peace, insecurity, and representations of war. My guest today is Helen Behrens. She has a PhD in International Relations and a BA Honours First Class from the University of Queensland. She's now a lecturer in the School of Justice, Faculty of Law, and a member of the Crime and Justice Research Centre at Queensland University of Technology. Her work is concerned with representations of youth in political events, as well as genuine engagement with the lived experiences of violence-affected young people. More broadly, she is interested in questions of how people experience and live with violence, how young people are politicised but not seen as political, and how feminist theory and methodology opens up spaces for new voices in international relations. Her work has been published in journals including the International Feminist Journal of Politics, Peacebuilding, Critical Studies on Security, and Signs. And her book, which you can find a link to in the show notes, is Young People and Everyday Peace. It's forthcoming with Routledge in a couple of months, but if you jump on our book depository page, you can find it. So please jump on there. And if you buy it, Helen gets a sweet commission, and we also get a sweet commission as well. So if Helen didn't write that book, we wouldn't be making money. Now, Helen, thanks for appearing on the show.
Thanks for having me. I enjoy the podcast, so it's lovely to be here in the illustrious company of your previous guests.
Okay, listeners and former guests, that's how you do it. That's it done right. Before we get into the details of our topic today, I'm keen to know, as I'm sure my listeners are, about how you found yourself researching how young people live with violence and the politicalisation, but not necessarily political empowerment, of these young people.
Well, in some ways, to answer this question, I have to go back to my childhood, which sounds like we're going to get into some deep territory, but I don't want you to panic, Mick. So when I was a kid, my parents took my sister and I to Latin America, and we lived there for 3.5 years. And I was about 9, 10 when we went. And I think this was probably the first time that I'd really confronted poverty, confronted disparity, inequality, and these really kind of complex social and political environment. That is visibly complex, right? All environments are complex. And obviously as expats, we were well positioned, off and comfortable in society. However, I'm really grateful that in that time that we had there, my parents would take us traveling, even just living where we lived, but take us traveling to a lot of different and quite difficult places. So I really, I guess, saw things and developed this appreciation for the importance of recognizing and trying to respond to inequality. And I guess what in hindsight, with my academic hat on, I can identify as radically different power relations and how they cause insecurity. So that's where I've always come from and asked those questions. So from there, I had an interest in that kind of thing. In my undergrad, I did both an anthropology major and also a fabulous major that the Political Science and International Studies School at UQ offers in Peace and Conflict Studies, which is part of the IR degree. And by the time I got to postgrad study, which I did in international relations, the enduring question was, where are the people in what we're talking about, which comes from my, anthropology background.
Yeah.
And I think this kind of dovetailed quite nicely with emerging interest in feminist international relations, which I was kind of exposed to at that point. And I mean, many scholars, but the one I keep returning to and the question I keep returning to is Cynthia Enloe, who asks this kind of a foundational question, where are the women in the structures and institutions that preoccupy, the things we study in international relations? And so this has kind of led me to draw on broader feminist IR work, as well as some work that links IR with embodiment theory, which is simply taking the presence of the body seriously and asking how people experience the world, to try and account for the people kind of that are in these spaces of conflict and insecurity. And then to get to like young people, as soon as I started asking that question, where are the women? I couldn't help but notice all the other groups that are overlooked in these discussions, right? Yeah. My anthropology background gives me a nice grounding in paying attention to everyday life and looking at these things and reading these things and kind of getting into postgrad study. I couldn't help but notice we never talk about young people, unless they appear as kind of boogeyman threats of violence, youths on the back of pickup trucks with, AKs and news stories, or these kind of images of passive children, these images that we see in the media in particular lately.
Yeah.
And there's so much missing between those two extremes about what young people do and experience and things in conflict and in peace. So it's those kind of three things kind of come together and brought me to this point, right, which is interested in how we talk or don't talk about young people in international relations, and then how we can talk about, people's lives meaningfully in these kind of spaces.
Wow, that's quite a what I'd like to call a twisty and turny path towards where you are now. I've actually had an experience with embodiment theory in Latin America myself after having some bad bootleg alcohol up near Ollantaytambo. So if you really want to experience embodiment theory, people, drink the local liquor. Now, like a good interviewer, and my listeners actually know that I happen to be an excellent interviewer apart from telling extremely personal jokes, I'm going to jump from that topic right to video games. Why? Because I'm a male in his 30s and I have a short attention span unless someone says video games. No, the reason I'm doing this is because it's linked to your research, and you recently co-authored a rather good article. It's actually a rather good article, so well done, on the absence of the everyday in video games that are based on war and combat. Hopefully you can explain what I mean by the everyday, because I'll just trip over my words if I try. But what does this absence in combat games indicate?
A good segue there. I have recently written a little article. So alongside some of my other work, you can talk about one of my interests is in representations of conflict and then particularly young people in them, which has meant across the years I've written about Harry Potter, particularly Hermione as an indicator of girls in conflict.
That's amazing.
To video games, to things like the photo of Alan Kurdi on the beach, to Malala Yousafzai as a figure in these kind of discussions. So, you know, I have this broader interest about representations in diverse forms and both pop culture and real life, I guess, about conflict. But this piece that you're referring to has been part of a long and ongoing conversation, actually, with my partner, who is a media and communications academic, who looks at video games as a cultural form. So we have these long, convoluted academic conversations at home, and the result is we wrote an article together, like all good academic couples should.
Sounds fascinating.
So in this piece, I guess, we talk about how real warfare in the real world is increasingly in many ways digitized or virtualized. So, I mean, an obvious target, but drones to various technological additions to soldiers, you know, kit in the field, those kind of things, and how video games, and we're talking particularly about, you know, AAA blockbuster, generally first-person shooters.
Yep.
Kind of adopt and extend these technologies often in their stories and game, often marketing the games as, you know, in quotes, like reality or authentic experience or in weapons or in environment, that kind of thing. And I think what the caution is for us is that in doing that, in digitizing and virtualizing it and making it super techie, what often ends up happening is we lose the complexity of battlefields when in some of these kind of games. So there often aren't civilians in video game battlefields. Bodies are killed and they'll, you know, vanish a couple of seconds later from the player's map. It's not strategic errors because you're being led through a story. And I think then we, in these kind of games, we only see certain bodies, certain kinds of bodies, and that these are very much cinematic. You know, AAA blockbusters are these fantastic, enormous visual spectacles, you know, incredibly choreographed. And I think what gets erased then in that is the messiness of real conflict and the people who live in these places who endure the effects of conflict. So in these environments, often far from the screens of who video games are predominantly marketed to, which isn't to say they're not played elsewhere, but predominantly marketed to, you know, the very different lives that are erased.
Yeah.
And I guess that kind of empty battlefield then that becomes part of the way we think about conflict because we're engaging in playing video games kind of limits our ability to imagine other possibilities than war, right?
Yeah.
To do things like empathize with the other side and those kind of things that are foundational for building peace and, you know, ending conflict and things. I really like the example of America's Army, which is the US Army's recruitment game, and but you play team versus team, but everybody plays as an American soldier. So the other team is always the bad guy, regardless of which team you're on your screen, you're playing as the American. So I just think things like that tell us really interesting things about how war is, I guess, kind of conceived by and produced for certain audiences, right? That they become kind of playgrounds that hide collateral damage, that you know, sidestep questions of crimes and things. And they're a multi-billion dollar industry, right? The military entertainment complex is this really real thing. And so I just think that we should think more critically. I'm not saying stop playing video games.
I'm not going to.
Don't come on the show and, you know, my reputation is to tell everyone to stop playing games or anything.
Well, the people on this show tend to read books more than games, so that's okay.
But I just think we should think about the depiction of conflict, you know, what they are depicting and what gets left out. I think pop culture is important. It's a reflection of society. And I think whether we're talking about first-person shooters or YA young adult books deserves to be taken seriously. So, I mean, that article, we're talking about these big first-person shooters, but I think it's also what's really interesting is that beyond kind of the blockbusters, there's a lot of other smaller, more critical games that I think perhaps also offer the potential for these kind of media to open up new reflections on the consequences of war. So This War of Mine, where you play as the civilian and you've got to survive. It's like really intense. And then other things like Unmanned, that you play out the life of a drone pilot. And, you know, those kind of things that give you another way of thinking about war beyond just the end of a gun, you know, kind of pointed into a digital space with no people in it except people to shoot at. So
it's interesting. I'm going to read a line from the from your article, just because it just struck me as a really, really great way of summing up this argument. The close intimacy, the umbilical connection between technologies of warfare and technologies of video games remains invested in perpetuating this construction of warfare as virtuous, virtual, but never visceral. I've just got one question on that. Did you just have the V section of your thesaurus out while you guys were writing this? That's a cracker of a sentence.
Oh, thank you very much. We got there. We had two and we played around. We were trying to find a third, you know. We like that alliteration.
When I read that, to be honest, it's the only thing I highlighted in the article, because I was just like, wow, that hit me. And
it's not a very long article. Your listeners should know it's a very short article. There wasn't much opportunity for highlighting.
they probably assume that because I've read it, so they realise it must be very short. But I want to jump now back to this idea of embodiment theory. And I guess I'm truly out of my depth when it comes to this sort of stuff, but I'm going to wade in anyway because we haven't got enough content yet for the episode, so I'm just going to keep going. But my question relates to your upcoming book and narratives of young people living with violence and insecurity. What can the everyday lives of people living with violence, and I'm not necessarily talking about soldiers here, I've talked about them enough on this show, I think. I'll talk about them next episode though, guys, don't worry. But what can the everyday lives of people living with violence teach us about politics and conflict?
Well, firstly, like, don't be put off about embodiment theory. You know, I think it's just meaningfully accounting for bodies and recognizing we're all just people in the world, and we impact on the world, and the world impacts on us.
Yeah.
And like all good academia, we just dress it up in fancy words to sell you complicated books. I have this, as I say, I have this interest in how people cope with insecurity and how people relate to power and experience those kind of things. And as you say, my interest tends to be more with civilians, people that live with violence, rather than people involved in the army and things, although that often comes into the work. Now, I guess the flippant answer about writing this book and its content was it gave me an opportunity to get back to Latin America, which I adore, and to spend more time with young people there, which is my favorite part of the work that I do. But, you know, anyone listening at QUT, I have valid academic reasons for going back. And I guess the more serious answer is that an attention to everyday lives, you know, kind of that local what goes on in people's daily lives has been very much absent, or at least very, very marginal to studying and talking about war and peace building, particularly in international relations.
Yeah.
So we talk about, you know, in international relations particularly, we talk about, you know, collateral, we talk about refugee populations by their, you know, numbers in the millions or whatever.
Yeah.
But often there isn't kind of this detailed attention to what actually goes on in people's lives. And so peace building, you know, do a little bit of academia at you. Peace building has long been about, I guess, what gets called the liberal peace, right? And that's the idea that in a post-conflict environment, if you can bring in democratic institutions, judicial institutions, you can rebuild economies, that kind of thing, that then equals peace somehow, right? And the rest will follow. And that these frameworks can be applied kind of across conflicts. But I think that there's growing recognition that this isn't, you know, this isn't wrong, but it isn't getting us all the way to solutions and responses to conflict. And so there's been this kind of debate in the last 10 years or so about paying attention to this local and what that often gets called everyday peace or post-liberal peace, because academics like being post something, you know, they come up with a new idea.
Just means you're better than the last person.
Exactly. I mean, post eventually. And I guess this really just looks to what is going on in local experience. So my book definitely is kind of situated in that, And it looks particularly at one community that lives on the outskirts of Colombia's capital in Bogota. And this is an informal and illegal community. The population is overwhelmingly has been forcibly displaced by the conflict. It's extremely poor. It lacks access to resources. It lacks access to government support. The territory where it is controlled and contested by gangs, by illegal groups. And so often, you know, when I was working there, I talked to someone, you know, from up in Bogota. They're like, why are you there? You know, it's just a bad place. Why would you want to go there? But the people who live there, they're not all drug dealers and criminals. They're mostly just people trying to get on with their life, right? They resist it. They work to strengthen the community. They organize. They petition the local government. You know, they do all this kind of stuff. And young people are a super active part of that as well. And young people in this community are often most at risk for recruitment by gangs. They're most at risk to experience violence from gangs. Their education gets interrupted. It's dangerous for them to walk around, right? Yet they kind of negotiate this stuff. They have really pointed critiques of the government, you know, and the absence of support. And they talk about what the future looks like. So they have this sense of aspiration for the future. So I think what then, my book does, but like kind of these kind of studies and thinking about the local and the everyday is offers a way of seeing, for me, this community, but others like it, not as like a black hole of violence, right, that the response should be contain it or go in with force, you know, by the police and the army, which often happens in that space as well. But like a space that's really complex, that has a lot of people living in it that are trying to resist violence, that are demonstrating resilience. And to kind of understand what kind of approaches a community like that takes then allows us to consider kind of bottom-up engagements and what can we learn from here and bring up or take to other places rather than, you know, fix the institutions and the rest will follow kind of approach of more traditional peace building. And so, you know, I'm making this argument in the context of Colombia, but it repeats, you know, I think it has resonance to other places.
Yeah.
I think the other thing also is that kind of contextualizes this focus and what I'm interested in is, you know, simply by the numbers, right? There are more young people now than ever globally. Yeah. It's about 2 billion of them. It depends how you cut off youth, you know, 1.8 to 2 point something.
You can tell almost by 90... all the hoodies and skateboards going around.
Almost 90% of them live in countries in the global south, which are also ones that are more often affected by conflict.
Yeah.
Just over a third of that 2 billion have been directly affected by conflict. And they participate in conflict, sure. You know, we can talk about child soldiers and youth radicalization and all those kind of things. But they also do a lot of things in those environments. They, you know, raise families. They work to support siblings. They run for office. They form organizations that advocate. You know, they live in refugee camps and survive, you know, whatever they're doing. They're not just passively waiting for rescue or waiting magically to turn 18 and suddenly, you know, be people that do things in the world. Yeah. And so I think it's foolish to ignore them if we want to meaningfully respond to conflict and to build lasting peace in these kind of places that have these enormous youth populations. So if young people aren't included in informal institutions which of politics and they're not, and, you know, it's a whole other conversation, then we're missing their activity entirely if we're not considering the local and the everyday. So I guess that's why I wrote the book, and I'm really excited it's almost out.
Just imagine how excited you'll be when it is out and all the royalties come rolling in. And
just going to tell your listeners to buy it for the library because, like all good academic books, it's ridiculously expensive. So ask your university library to buy it, you know, if you can't afford it.
No, listeners, don't do that. Buy it through our affiliate site so that I get money for it. No, that's one of the interesting things you mentioned there was the Global South and the Palgrave Handbook of Criminology and the Global South has actually just recently come out. And there's some people from your faculty that have written some cracker chapters in there. So I just thought I'd advertise that book as well.
Oh, thank you very much. People will be very pleased.
No worries. I don't have an affiliate link to that yet. But listeners, please just go through our bookshelf on our website and search for it. Because those academic books bring in some nice commissions. If your library does want to buy them, send them through our website. Now, Helen, I'm going to get to my penultimate question. Now, I'm sure you know what penultimate means, but I've got a lot of obtuse listeners out there. So for those listeners...
No, they're not nice.
You're right.
No, you're not.
And for those listeners who don't know what it means my second to last question. It's a translation from the Chinese. Now, this question is a very good question, in my opinion. It's about concepts we've discussed so far. Well, actually, concepts you've discussed and I've sort of fumbled around. We've discussed war, we've discussed the experience of those people living through it, we've discussed the absence of the everyday in portrayals in video games. We've also talked a little bit about, and to use your term here, the telegenic dead, when we talk about representations of young people in the wider representation of war, and particularly the you know, the case of Alan Kurdi, which you've written an article on that you gave a presentation on, called Apprehending the Telegenic Dead, Considering Images of Dead Children in Global Politics. I urge
the
my
fun
listeners.
Topics.
Yeah. Like, man.
Like, see, sometimes. Now, there's no joke.
Yeah, no, there's no joke there. Some days you just got to like read something and then go have like a case of wine. But my question is this: why is it important to study the experiences of those on the margins and how they're portrayed in war and conflict?
So I think there's a really simple and quick, and you know, be pleased to know, as an academic, I can do it quickly, answer, which is we simply aren't getting the full picture if we're not including these small, sometimes mundane, sometimes radical actions that go on in the margins of conflict. That's kind of a quick answer. The longer answer is that we understand the world through what we can see and what we can imagine. So whether that's video games or other pop culture, or whether that's the scope of a discipline, it shapes how we understand and make sense of the world. So I often joke that I'm very poorly disciplined, by which I mean I locate myself as an IR academic, but I draw on anthropology, as I've talked about, feminist philosophy. I draw upon the sociology of childhood because they're much better at talking about children, because IR doesn't do it, to kind of talk about these ideas because they offer us something different to what we're used to seeing. So these ideas that I guess on the margin to the discipline, right, to try and bring them in.
Yeah.
And so that when it comes to war and peace building, these are difficult, they're complex, you know, like many of your podcasts have attested to, your conversations. They're intractable situations that have emerged both from, you know, high politics at the space of the state, but also kind of the social and cultural environment that has caused some kind of rupture, right? And I guess if we don't include the experiences of those on the margins, then we're reinforcing those kind of schemas of inequality and power that I talked about earlier. And we're limiting our ability to solve problems, and we're limiting our ability to build sustainable responses that are grounded in people's lived experience. So I guess it just seems like common sense to me that we should be expanding our field of vision and taking into account as much as we possibly can if we're serious about trying to respond to these kind of problems.
It's a very interesting response, because it links into a lot of what has been said on the show, which proves that you're actually a listener and not just paying it lip service,
it's
which
not
is
empty
good.
So
obviously the research has been done on the show as well, which is good. We'll tighten up our quality. It's not true. We'll always be this amateur. Now, look, Helen, I'd love to sit here and talk about this all night, but to be honest, I've got another interview coming up, and you probably have done enough to sell your books, so we're good. So let's go to the final question. Now, each guest is asked to finish a sentence, and this sentence relates to our mission on this show, which is very similar to that of Big Karl von Clausewitz, the original dead Prussian. Now, he probably wasn't the very first dead Prussian, but he's definitely the first one that warmed our hearts with his really cold and unemotional writing. It's about framing the debate, and the way we frame the debate we have about war and warfare within society is quite important. This show hopes to help that debate by defining it in as many ways as possible, and we get our guests to define it. Some of our listeners try and do it on social media, pretty good listeners, but our guests tend to be better, mainly because they provide audio content. So now, Helen, I invite you to offer a definition and engage in the debate and help us frame it. Please finish the sentence, war is.
I have a long and a short one for tweeting purposes for you,
Excellent.
If that's helpful.
That's perfect.
So War is an inefficient response to political problems which causes avoidable suffering. The short one for you is war is avoidable suffering.
Wow, war is avoidable suffering. Oh, that's kind of hits you really hard, doesn't it? That's good. And also, like, I've actually addressed this with some of our other guests. Now that Twitter's decided to ruin their platform with 280 characters, like, people, you can come up with, I should ask people to finish the paragraph war is from now on.
I was just going to say, like, your academic guests should be thrilled, right? We can just write like, entire paragraphs.
Yeah, that's right.
Caveats, footnote it.
But war is avoidable suffering. That's brilliant. What I would really like to do is grab a heap of guests in like a debate on stage, because I'd like to put war is avoidable suffering up against someone who's offered war is tragic but necessary. That would be great to see that debate. But that's not actually what we're here to do. And what we're going to do next is actually thank you for coming on the show, Helen. It's been a very interesting topic. It's been a discussion that's on an area that we haven't really covered on the show before, and hopefully the listeners got a bit out of it. And we're going to keep trying to diversify as much as possible, listeners, so that we can really frame this debate in a way that enables a conversation about war and warfare that hopefully goes towards ending it for good. Will take me another, I'll say 2.5 years before I can do that. But Helen's work and research is a very different angle from the way I know a lot of the TDP community look at it. So it's always worth getting in there and getting a new perspective. Helen, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And all right, listeners, you can support Helen by one, buying her book through the show notes. Reading her articles, you can find them by going to the QUT Law and Justice Faculty website. Just type in either Helen's name or something, QUT Law and Justice in Google. That's how lazy I am. Just do that in Google. You guys Google it and you will find it. There's some great publications she's written. I really encourage you to read the one on video games and representation, particularly for those people who have served out there. And what you'll find when you do it, you will not play a computer game the same way, and you'll wonder to yourself why you didn't notice that before. You can also support Helen by following her on Twitter at HMBerents, that's B-E-R-E-N-T-S, and you can also find her book in the show notes, as I mentioned. Now, listeners, I also thank you for your iTunes reviews, your feedback. I'm getting hammered by spam bots on the contact page on the website, which is really, really good. I'm currently talking to our webmaster to try and fix that. But in the meantime, I've noticed there's a few episodes that have had some issues. If you have had an issue with listening to an episode, if there's been problems with the audio, please, critical feedback is not a problem. Reviews that say too many mouth noises are a bit weird, but any other critical feedback, just send to deadprussian@gmail.com. That's deadprussian@gmail.com. You can feel free to spam the inbox, because I need to know if you've got a problem with any of our episodes out there and you want it fixed, please let me know. If you want to leave a one-star review saying that there's too many mouth noises, just don't listen to the show. And also, check out the Patreon page if you have time and if you have a little bit of extra coin at the end of each pay cycle. But until next time, listeners, grab a book and crack on.
Join the conversation with us on Twitter at Dead Prussian Pod, on Facebook at The Dead Prussian Page, or on our website www.thedeadprussian.com. All show notes for this episode, as well as copyright information, can be found on the website. The Dead Prussian Podcast is written, produced and hosted by Mick Cook. It is co-produced by Amanda Levito. The music used throughout is Caught in the Beat by Broke for Free and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. All opinions expressed by individuals on the podcast are those of the individual and not necessarily representative of any other organisation.